Anthony Gormley is a British sculptor, best known for his striking installation of human figures outdoors, be they on beaches, in the sea, on the top of city buildings, or, as in the case of his most iconic work, Angel of the North, on a hilltop outside Gateshead. His art has always connected with the entire tradition of sculpture, going back in time, looking east and west, and I'm sure he'd want me to add north and south, so it's fitting that he now explores that tradition in a new book, Shaping the World, Sculptor from Prehistory to Now, and it's a book written in collaboration with art critic Martin Grayford. Delighted to have Anthony Gormley join me on the line this evening. In fact, it's the form of it's a conversation, really, between yourself and Martin Grayford. Anthony, when did the conversation start?
Well, it's lovely to talk to you, Sean. It started, about 20 years ago. I had a show at Santiago de Compostela, and Martin was sent over by his paper, and that's when we first met. And I have to say that we didn't see so much of each other. I mean, I read this incredible Life of Michelangelo that he wrote, wrote to him saying how much I admired it. And then he suggested that, as he'd done these couple of books with David Hockney about looking at pictures, that he would like to do one about looking at things, and suggested that we might do it together. And so he started coming to my studio, and over 2 years, we had these chats, and we'd send each other, you know, pictures of things that we thought were interesting to talk about. So he did all the heavy, legwork, and I just sat and chatted. And but it's turned out really, beautifully, I think. And I have to, I just take my hat off to him. Yeah. It was a very, very enjoyable process.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the fact that Martin had done a book of around paintings with David Hockney. Because there was no doubt in your mind you weren't going to be talking about paintings. Sculpture is the king of the arts. That is more or less what you say from the very outset here. What do you think gives it such primacy?
Well, I think it's the difference between a thing in the world and a picture. A picture, it depends on a surface. That surface depends on a wall. A wall depends on a roof. I mean, there's a sense. I mean, yes, we all know that there are, paintings in caves. There are paintings on rock shelters in Australia that have survived for thousands of years. But on the whole, paintings are, they are dependent on context and on protection. And sculpture doesn't have that dependency. It is something that can, as you've just said about my work, be anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's the exciting thing, is because you put this still silent object in the stream of life, and suddenly it starts doing something. It's active. It's a foreign object in a world that is, on the whole, functional or elemental. And immediately there's a conversation that goes on, and I think that's what gives it its excitement. It's a proposition. It's a materialized proposition that in some way confronts the world, and that's a very different thing to making a picture.
Yeah, it's not, there's more involved here than, to paraphrase Orwell, it's not just a case of three dimensions good, two dimensions bad. There's more involved than that.
Yeah, I think, for me, well, it was interesting because I thought we were, because he's a Renaissance scholar, I thought we might get stuck in the Renaissance. But he was happy to come out of his comfort zone and go, in a way, to places that might not traditionally have been thought of sculpture at all. So, the caves of Ellora and Ajanta, or the stones of Stenness, in the Orkneys, the idea that actually this notion of maybe not making figurative or copies of bodies identifies sculpture, but the sculpture is about place making. It's about marking territory. It's about taking a stone that was lying, a naturally formed stone that was lying, and standing it up, and thereby making a place in space at large, and at the same time marking a time, marking a kind of moment in a you could say geological narrative where human beings begin to want to intervene in time that is beyond mortal time.
On that particular topic, in the idea of taking a stone and putting it, moving it to its position, whatever, in the landscape and making an intervention in that respect, did you actually visit Uisneach in County Westmeath? Did you spend time there?
Of course I did.
Yeah,
of
and what struck I you did. About it? What struck you?
Well, what's amazing about the Cat Stone on Uisneach Hill is that it's a naturally formed glacial erratic. But it has this extraordinary presence. And, of course, the hill that it's on has this extraordinary, ability to look at whatever, 13 counties of Ireland. And you could say that this is a kind of natural thing that then human beings have tried to copy, like Mount Fuji. Mount Fuji is a naturally made thing, but it's a marker in space that people have recognized has a kind of iconic form. And it's interesting to me that actually, that notion of a mountain has found its material equivalent in humanly made, whether it's Silbury Hill or these great stupas, at Sanchi or in Kandy all over the Southeast Asia.
In fact, there's one of the early people that I must say too, the illustrations in the book are quite extraordinary. Some of the photographs that we get are amazing. you could flick through.
Well, it wasn't me. It was Rosalind Horn, who's my wonderful kind of assistant at the studio, who deals with publication. She spent about 6 months chasing. We have this wonderful picture of people cleaning the great Buddha in Nara in Japan. If it hadn't been for her absolute insistence that she wasn't going to use conventional images of Karnak or of Stonehenge, but she was going to find really, really sparkling, like new views of old known things. And that makes a big difference.
Yeah, one of the ones that really struck me, and it's quite early in the book, if I remember correctly, is Parin Arvana. The Parin Arvana, if I'm saying that word correctly, the Buddha in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, Polonnaruwa. Polonnaruwa, which I visited. I was a good hippie and went east for about 3 years. And that was another of those encounters for me, rather like the encounter, with the head of Amenhotep II in the British Museum, that just stopped me in my tracks and made me feel this is the thing. Being able to take a bit of a mountain and turn it into this sublime image of, in a way, the relationship between consciousness and matter, which is what the sleeping Buddha of Polonnaruwa is. I mean, it's just amazing. It's maybe 18 meters long. The head alone is the size of a man. He's lying on its side. But what's incredible about it is the way that, the stucco surface that must have been original to it has all worn off in time, and the stratification of the rock, below that surface, has now become, in a way, a kind of geological evocation of the way that the mind flows through matter. And that was a moment for me. It's literally a mountain that has been formed by human hand.
Yeah, and I mean, as you say, looking at the picture is quite an exhilarating experience. I can only imagine what standing in front of the actual figure must be. You go so far to say, Anthony Gormley, that in fact sculpture, if I'm not misquoting you or putting words into your mouth here, was kind of the first form of language, or certainly an initial, perhaps, mode of communication within communities?
Yeah, I would say that the touching, the reassurance that we have about the world comes through touch. And, you know, in the book there is this 1.7, 1.5, 1.7 million year old little 3-inch in diameter, almost perfect spherical object that is called a bolus. And it was found in Olduvai, the place where our kind of proto-hominid ancestor, Australopithecus afarensis, was found by Leakey a long time ago. And the idea, we know that language was not possible. We didn't have the palate. We didn't have the shape of the mouth or the action of the tongue that was able to make words. However, it's very clear that this is a humanly made object that looks uncannily, because it's made out of this calcium carbonate that sort of sparkles, it looks uncannily like the moon. And the idea that, you know, our ancient ancestors made this thing and then passed it from hand to hand, you know, for me, is a really powerful idea of a form of communication that is material.
Yeah, it's a blind version of
language.
Yeah, it's a blind version of Pass the Parcel in some ways. A very, very different. I wonder, was it a very different?
Well, except that the parcel is unwrapped from the very beginning, and the unwrapping has to happen in the mind of the holder. The association of this thing that has a certain weight and density with perhaps the largest, found object in deep space, the moon. Might or might not occur to you, but it certainly occurred to me on seeing this object.
How different do you think, because you do draw a quite a strong distinction here between statuary and sculpture. How important is that difference, or what are we talking about when we start recognising that difference?
Well, I think that at a certain stage in kind of certainly in European culture, the statue took over from a wider idea of I guess material culture shaping the world, and became in a way the commonplace for sculpture, which is a very small part of the total. And it sort of took on the duty of representing and supporting power. So statues of either mythological gods or powerful politicians or kings or naked women, sexy women, became in a way the equivalent of sculpture. And I think it lost, as it were, the magic of its placemaking and in a way confrontational potential. And I use my own body as a found object. I'm not pretending that it has intrinsic beauty, but I try to make, as it were, these industrial fossils that you could say act like standing stones. They are markers in space and time, but they are there in a way to reorientate us to notions of scale, to the relationship between skin and horizon, for example. There's a bit of a paradox about me kind of saying, even though I make works that carry, as it were, the index of the body, that I should be so questioning of the limitations of statue, but I think my work works very, very differently. It's very important, for instance, when it's on the ground, that it shares the ground with the viewer. It isn't on a plinth. It isn't an idealized thing. It's very important that it's often multiple. In other words, it betrays the fact that it comes from a time of mechanical reproduction. And what? I think thereby it acts on us differently to, as it were, the unique, isolated plinthed object of a statue.
And I suppose in the case of plinthed objects, we're certainly talking about that in the case of the slave trader Edward Colson and the statue that was toppled into the harbour in Bristol, or indeed the protests around Cecil Rhodes, the statue at Oxford University. Where do you stand on the toppling or the dismantling of those statues? Indeed, we had our own controversy here.
Well, my feeling is that we can't escape our own history by hiding evidence of it. I would not remove Rhodes. I did I did suggest that they just left him on his plinth, but turned him to face the wall. I think that, you know, the Robert E. Lee monuments have become kind of magnets for white supremacy in the southern states of North America are another case in point. I would not, as it were, remove them. I think that we are all victims, whether we were perpetrators or slaves, of that history. And I think that we need to be very, very careful about how we learn from history. And we certainly don't learn from it by amnesifying ourselves from its from its memory.
Lovely to speak with you this evening, Anthony. Every best wish to you and yours for 2021.
Lovely to talk to you, Sean, too. Take care.
All
bye
the best.
For now.
That's Anthony Gormley, and he was speaking to us about his book, Shaping the World, Sculpture from Prehistory to Now, by Anthony Gormley and Martin Gifford. It's published by Thames and Hudson.